Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Publisher Lab. And joined truly alongside me today is Producer Manny. Producer Manny, welcome back and welcome to the chair. You've been moving on up.
It feels nice. I got armrests now, or before my arms were kind of all over the
place. Yeah, we made you just hold them up in the air until the podcast
was done. Yeah.
It's a weird thing for us to do.
I had signs back there, but we don't need those signs
anymore. So it's nice to have you back in front of the camera, and it's nice to welcome everyone to 2024, the current year that we're in. If you're listening to this from the past, wow, it's impressive. And if you're listening to us from the future also, actually that's probably more accurate just because it'd be impossible to listen to us at the present because we don't stream this show live. Maybe one day.
Yeah. If there's enough requests for it, I'd be more than happy to do a live stream. And then you get all the errors that we have on camera that I typically cut out.
Yeah. And there's probably quite a lot. That blooper reel is probably pretty good.
Oh, I keep a folder on my desktop for all the bloopers since I've started here, and I got some good ones.
I won't be running for political office. That's what everybody can take away from that. The thing that I wanted to bring up on that note was that feedback is super helpful. We got a couple people that that went to publisherlab.org and submitted feedback, comments, questions, that sort of thing. We love it. One of the things we talk about a lot on the show is being able to interact with your audience and, you know, making content, you know, for your users, your visitors, your listeners. And that's exactly why we do this show and why we've continued to do it. So all your feedback is appreciated. And yeah, if you want to be a part of the show, that's the best way to do it. And from there, we'll kick off 2024 with news related to somebody that I have a feeling we didn't get rid of them this year, and I don't think we're going to get rid of them anytime soon because they're a staple of our industry. So Google's up first, I guess.
Yeah, so Google's still around. Unless you're really listening to this from like way out into the future. But for right now, January 2024, they're still here.
I can just imagine somebody listening and be like, when was this made? That was way before
Google. Oh, I haven't heard that name in a long time.
Yeah, it was way before IBM made that swift comeback and took over search.
IBM, you mean DuckDuckGo. We do have a news story here from searchengineland.com where Google's new SGE, they had some data from Bright Edge where they kind of did a comprehensive SEO look at Google search generative experience, and they noticed that it now affects 84% of search queries, displaying in three main formats, being opt-in, collapsed, and none. Bright Edge did reveal that unordered lists are common in SGE content, with variants including detailed descriptions or interactive elements. A significant 38% of SGE instances feature a location module with maps. For product searches, 8% of SGE content consists of product viewers. And notably, Google is incorporating warnings in the SGE answers for categories like age, financial, medical, legal, and dangerous. Additionally, Google experiments with different product displays formats in SGE, such as a product listing with source descriptions and various carousel groupings. So we're definitely starting to see SGE being more prominent when someone searches something on Google. And in another report, same from Search Engine Land, Authoritas, which is a great name for a website.
I know, I can imagine, I kind of feel like they're like a, like it's a tortilla chip commercial, you know, like I can almost hear their theme song in my head.
Maybe that's why I like it so much. Being Mexican, it's just kind of like, you know, it hits me in my roots.
Yeah, you're like, that's the brand that I want to both use for SEO and also like for dip.
Yeah. Well, they did a recent study on SGE as well, and they found some startling findings. The study that was conducted in December 2023 analyzed 1,000 commercial keywords across a variety of categories, and their key discovery was that a whopping 93.8% of the time, Google's search generative experience answers featured links that were completely different from the top 10 organic search results. And this revelation highlights a significant and potential impact on organic website traffic as users increasingly find answers directly through Google's AI-generated responses. Interestingly, the study also found that the SGE links rarely matched organic search results. They do often introduce new URLs, typically showcasing around 4 unique links from different websites, yeah. And the prevalence of SGE in search results was notable, appearing for nearly 87% of the analyzed keywords. And these are crucial findings to understanding the evolving landscape of search engine usage and its implication on website traffic, particularly for publishers.
Yeah, and it really is. From the standpoint of, I think these are probably things that... those that listen to this podcast that, you know, obviously this is something that you have to pay a lot of attention to if you're garnering a lot of web traffic from Google, which, I mean, it's hard to imagine many scenarios in which you're not. But I assume that most of our listeners are, you know, probably pretty familiar with the search results page and sort of how it's been evolving. So these are not things that I don't think have gone unnoticed. Most of what they discuss here, like, as you kind of hear these things, do they ring sort of like true? Can you kind of visualize in your mind sort of like what those things look like?
Yeah. I actually, we were talking to a coworker yesterday and she's getting a new dog and she was naming her dog after a city in Greece. And so we were kind of looking up like different cities in Greece, yeah. And never once did I go to a website because all the responses for a bunch of different cities, yeah. In Greece with maps and locations showed up at the very top.
It's a really great example. We know how, you know, I'm famous for how apt my examples are, often way off track. But the thing with that one is, in particular, that I find that with our search page, we generally are thinking, like, how do I just get on it, right? Like, rich snippets were a big thing for a long time where it's like, if you could get the rich snippet, you could, you know, go number one to the knowledge graph. And even if the knowledge graph is maybe giving you the full answer and people weren't going to the page, it's like, what do you got to lose? If they're going to do that somewhere, might as well be yours. At least it gets the link at the top, right? Now I think you have to be, this is another evolution where it's like, This evolution I don't mind. I don't like that our industry has made it added layers of complexity for publishers. You think about something like an ads.txt for ads or even search. You know, like I think whenever they started asking for schema markup or allowing schema markup, I was like, you know, that's in the publisher's prerogative because that's markup that they don't really need to have on their site because it doesn't necessarily benefit the users. It really just benefits search engines and crawlers and different things like that, which can benefit the publisher too. But this is a case where I think the layer that gets added on as a responsibility is for quality. And what I mean by that is not necessarily quality for Google, but you think about, you're going to actually have to get better. And again, you remember last year I said publishers are going to have to start thinking more like social media or influencers or creators. So imagine this, like you make a great blog post or you write an article and in the middle of it, you have this really great, like, I don't know, maybe it's a graph or it's a chart or it's a diagram of how something works and somebody wants to see that. That's what they're looking for when they search. So they search, boom, there's that content right there. I-framed essentially into the search results page and they're looking at it. They got what they needed. They want to leave. So you just made content for free for Google. Now somebody, if it's not you, it might be somebody else, right? So like it's that same rich snippet like scenario again, but not necessarily because if you're making content that is that good and Google's taking it, you know, pieces of it like that, you're going to have to basically find ways to kind of like, hold the gun back to Google's head where you're going to be able to show something to the users, but then you need the user to be like, well, I need or want to know more. So wanting to know more is the desirable one here because it's the easier of the two where it's like, how do you give partial information? So like if you have a graph or a diagram, how do you break it up into two, right? Or how do you take these things and how do you, you know, sort of like lay out a table where you have like, you know, maybe one axis in table one and then another axis in table two, because Google can't take multiple components of your content and bring that over. I think that they're going to start getting eyes on them for something like that. But the other side of that is, let's say you're like, there's really not a smart way to do this. You can essentially take something where it's like, unless a component or a piece of your, and this doesn't work for text, it'll just work for images and other rich data, SVGs, you know, you name it, video. And what you can do is you can actually set a, I forget what, like drawing a blank, but it's the referrer, it's like the referrer endpoint. You can look it up, just be like referrer only works on my root domain or whatever. But you can make it so that elements of your content only work on your root domain, which would mean that that image would only show whenever it's displayed on your website. And if it was tried to be displayed elsewhere, it wouldn't show. Now, that is the same as like basically not showing it at all if you can't get the traffic to it, right? Well, you could use something like an SVG, or you could basically take an image and then you could put the text over it. There's multiple ways you could do this, but you could actually make it, and Statistica does this. It's a good example, by the way, of where it's like you go and you want to find, like, you know, ad spend globally for the last 10 years, and you look at it and there's the chart, but like the numbers aren't filled in. The numbers are just blank. And it's because the text content of that is in a tag that has rel refer equals, you know, false or whatever it is. And the rest of it is true. So when Google goes to steal that, they can only steal the chart. They can't steal the content. And that's because Statistica hides that content because it's subscription-based. But they do want to show people, like, look, this chart's here. And if you want to pay for it, we'll give you the numbers. And I think the publishers, the smart ones, are going to start doing that, especially if you make great content like that. Because it used to be making that great content that, you know, like, you could care less about the knowledge graph snippets being stolen because you're like, if that's all they wanted, they weren't going to stay long anyways. But when you put time and money into content and you make something that's original and unique and somebody else takes it, you want something for it. And I think it's worth time and investment to make sure that, you know, you're not taken advantage of in this. I wish I could tell you there's something else you could do, but that would be my approach with something along those lines.
Just to kind of piggyback off of what you said, that you're going to start seeing people kind of embed SVGs and then have text over images to try to kind of prevent their content being stolen. I remembered while doing research, there was an article, I believe, from Verge that had Google has perfected the internet of some sorts, but their website didn't operate like a normal blog article would, where you would expect to see a header image and then you scroll down. Instead, it was kind of like Apple's website, where as you scroll, the SVG animation plays, and within that animation is where the text is. So chunks of the blog post are actually hidden within this animation, so it's harder to take.
And here's the like, this is where Google's like brilliant, is that they crawl websites with the most current version of Chrome now, and I think they even use Canary sometimes. And so what that means is they're very picky about JavaScript, and whenever you have something that isn't hasn't been compiled to HTML, or the crawler can't basically like render instantly, it reads that as there's just like no content on the page, or whatever content's not visible like upon load, that's not available. So from an SEO standpoint, like, oh darn, like we can't read your content, so that's your fault that we're not indexing your stuff. But realistically, there are elements of that where it's like, you, especially your rich data and stuff like that, it's time to start looking at that. And if you're like, this doesn't really apply to me, I think then you maybe have a bigger problem, because like you said, you know, the search generative experiences, this stuff isn't just text. It's a variety of things. And if nothing else, it's how you're tagging and marking up your content with unordered lists. Like you mentioned, these things have been known, but like, I think, what do people want? You know, like, you're also competing with AI now, and AI is something that can deliver succinct information the way that people want it. Like, you think about the way that you present information as a publisher, it's opinionated, right? Like, I like to write, or I think that people want a long answer, but maybe people don't want a long answer. And so you got to give people what they want. And what they want a lot of times is the information condensed and to the most easily consumable way. So I think you have to do that while also fighting against Google. That's the greatest challenge you have as a publisher today. But I think that that's the challenge. I think the risk, though, is that the alternative potentially, and this is kind of it's a nice bridge story into our next one. You and I were talking about this before the podcast, but, you know, one of the things that they noticed in the study, right, was that there was like maybe less traffic going to publishers because of this sort of like diversification of like organic traffic, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think you said something along the lines of like, we might have, you know, millions more in traffic, but there's just more locations where it's going to.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the thing is, publishers might see overall less traffic if you're one of those publishers, and overall, like, your site's doing well. It's not your fault. You're not just jamming out crappy AI-generated content or something. You're experiencing what large enterprise publishers have been experiencing for the last two decades. This myth of, you know, the big sites keep getting more traffic and the little ones get less is incredibly false. It's been the exact opposite for almost a decade, where the large publishers are always conceding more and more to a greater diversity of publishers. There's more websites created all the time, and it's been in Google's best interest, theoretically. Not saying this is their motivation. I doubt they'd admit that. But it's every decision that they've made. If you diversify all the sources of where content comes from, you have zero chance of being, you know, have legislation or judiciary proceedings taking place over the course of, you know, like, is this, you know, collusion? Is it antitrust? But furthermore, it takes away the negotiation power of all those parties. So if, like, Google could probably get all the information that users want from 100 sources, maybe the majority of it, I bet, especially if you include something like Wikipedia. And with that, like, they could just cut out all other publishers. Like, seems like it'd be easier to deal with, right? The problem with that is then if you're the New York Times or whoever one of these sources are, you can band together, you can kind of unionize against Google, and you have this stronger negotiation position. But no publisher has negotiation position against Google today because there's so many. You'd have to get so many publishers on the same page. And this is why advertisers, you know, like, they basically default to, like, these big public boycotts and things like that with ad spend whenever they get fed up, because it's all they can do. They can only protest because they can't go to Google and ask for a better deal.
Right.
But I'm afraid that in some ways the alternative might be worse. And that sort of leads us into our next story.
Yeah. So we got a story coming from TechCrunch.com, and it says that the New York Times wants to OpenAI and Microsoft to pay for their training data. So the New York Times is suing OpenAI and Microsoft, alleging copyright violations from using its content to train generative AI models like ChatGPT and Copilot. The lawsuit demands the destruction of models and training data incorporating the Times content, alongside claims for substantial damages. The Times asserts that these AI models have not only used its articles without permission, but also misrepresented information as being from the Times. This lawsuit highlights concerns over how generative AI models might unintentionally replicate training data, benefiting from the Times' journalism without appropriate compensation. The impact on the news subscription and web traffic is a key issue, mirroring a similar suit against Google. While some publishers have opted for licensing agreements with AI firms, the Times attempts at negotiating such an agreement with OpenAI and Microsoft earlier in April, and it was unsuccessful. Legal experts note that the challenge of these lawsuits, especially if users manipulate AI to reproduce copyrighted content.
So Microsoft the New York Times wants Microsoft and OpenAI to delete the training data, which is responsible for this. I think it's the valuation of it's close to $100 billion now, you know, like the underlying sort of like properties of this technology. Who thinks that's going to happen?
It's a long shot.
It's not even a long shot. I mean, I can't imagine like what they're probably paying the attorneys to go to war on this. And I just think it's, I mean, I guess somebody's got to do it. It's probably like not for profit pro bono stuff that's taking place over like intellectual property rights and stuff. But my God, what a stupid battle to have, because there's just no way that's happening. Right. I can't express that enough. There's just no way. Now, I thought you brought up a great kind of counterpoint when we were talking about this story before the podcast. And that was that, you know, like, is this, they basically said, like, they can't have an OpenAI, you can't have these ChatGPT models without infringing on copyright, right?
Right. So we're jumping a few stories ahead, but yes, OpenAI did openly admit that it would be impossible to keep AI models like ChatGPT without copyright
infringement. So I think, you know, you could kind of look at it in the spirit of, well, they don't have to destroy it, but like they need to pay us for it. Well, parsing through what they need to pay for and how much, like what, I mean, like that's going to be hard. And, you know, a judge can make a ruling or whatever. But the bigger thing is that this is true. And these things can all be true. Yet at the end of the day, nothing might get done about that.
Right.
And the reason why I say that is because sometimes innovation means that like things change, and the New York Times can be right about this and basically be the poster boy for like, well, this is when we decided that we weren't really going to look at copyright the same way anymore. And maybe it's not. And, you know, like they may throw the book at OpenAI. It depends on sort of the political, economic, you know, like social climate, I think to some degree. But in addition to that, I think what we have to look at is intellectual copyright, especially as it relates to AI, is not the same thing as me taking somebody's content. It's the same as me reading the New York Times.
Right.
So if I was stealing the New York Times content and using it, there's a clear infringement. If I read the New York Times and that's a source for where I get some of my information, like I can't be, you can't hold me accountable for like what information I learn as a person. So AI is going to have a similar parameter, but I think what you are going to see is that there are going to be probably rulings around sort of like the transparency and how these models get built and the pipelines that feed into them, because I think you will want to know when, you know, like something shady is going on. So like if I put something behind a paywall, or I'm Statista, for example, and I have all these great like studies and stuff that people pay for to get the data, OpenAI, let's say one of their AIs, or they, you know, they buy one personal subscription, it cleans out all the data. And then when people ask it questions, that Statista data is available in OpenAI. Well, that's a clear sort of like workaround. And it's against like the terms and conditions of like, you know, what that license provides. So I do think that as a publisher, when you do have unique content, you're going to have to start having these sort of like content license agreements and things like that. But then you're going to have, I hate to say it, it's going to end up being like how ads became like a decade ago, where you've got, you know, you've got ad servers and data management platforms, because you're going to have to do your own tracing. The thing is like publishers realized, you know, enterprise ones a long time ago, that like, you can't rely on advertisers and Google to be like, we showed your ads to, you know, or advertisers learned this, you know, we showed your ads to a million people, trust us. They're like, okay, like on what sites, you know? They're like, these ones. And you're like, okay. And then all of a sudden advertisers started requiring that publishers that wanted to run their ads put these, you know, these ad tags or these tracking software. So now if you go look at any page with ads, they're just littered with all these tracking tags because the advertisers want their own data. Like Google's data isn't good enough. They want a tag on the page that's telling them, feeding them the data of all their impressions, because there's always discrepancies, even when they track it, you know, like, and some of it's like just bizarre edge cases. It's not anything nefarious, but like, this is what publishers are going to want too, is like, you're going to need to know like who pulled my content from my site, why, and are they doing the right things with it? But again, it's like a layer of complexity that gets added to all of this. But I do think that, hopefully it's not that route, because that one puts the onus on the publishers. You know, I'm hopeful that there'll be, you know, channels for this sort of thing that actually maybe empower publishers and give them more options with content. That's the sunny side up of something like this is, that potentially it gives publishers more options, not fewer. But that one concern here is basically the core of this, the next story, which is, you know, the part that bridges with our last one of like Google giving it being in their best interest to send lots of publishers, visitors and traffic, but OpenAI and ChatGPT maybe having a different incentive.
Yeah. Yeah. And you brought up a really interesting like philosophical point, where it's, if you're reading the New York Times and that's your training data to use their language, you're able to then reproduce content using that data that you learned, but an AI software is, you know, there's this weird gray area. So it's going to be...
How much, you and I can't do this show if it's not for reading the news. Like, we read so many industry publications to prepare for the show. Mm-hmm. like, what are we supposed to do? Like,
right.
Go wait outside of Google offices and be like, is anything changing today?
Yeah. You know? Exactly. So it's going to be interesting. And I think that's going to go down to like political language and lawyers fighting about what copyright means, what a person is. Yeah. AI a person? Can AI use training
data? There will have to be some revelations. And I think that there will be some stunning moments where it's like, I think that a lot of lawmakers and, I mean, consumers even are going to find out maybe surprising things about how some of these models work or trained or what their plans are in the future. And those things may be surprisingly, I mean, I don't know, but there's things about, if we knew exactly how some of these things were operating internally and how these models were working, we wouldn't be going to court to find out.
Right. And then maybe that's more of a push for that transparency that people want with AI, and hopefully we see more of that like nutrition label style thing. So when AI provides you data, it lets you know like, hey, we used content from the New York Times, from the Guardian, or wherever it may be.
I think that's definitely like more of the line of where I think something could go, where it's like, at least then you know a composite. Like, I like to know what the ingredients are, at least in the stuff that I'm eating. The thing that's hard with AI is you don't really know what, like, if I read a bunch of information and then you ask me a question and then I give you an answer, it's really hard for me to tell you exactly like how I came up with that particular answer. Right. Now, I could say I read this article, I read that article, and it's fairly accurate. But then as you grow in complexity and what you ask me about is like, Tyler, why do you like, what's your favorite color? It's green. But why is it green?
Right.
You know, like, I don't know. I don't know. And it's me.
Right.
You know?
It's just like a subjective thing.
Correct. And I think it's like, I could probably list for you the factors or the variables and the inputs and things like that throughout the course of my life of why I prefer that color. And it might be accurate.
Okay.
But it's based on my memories and my experiences and stuff like that. And that's if AI at its best is, it will be no different than that, where it's like just the layers of this sort of like dendrite neuron style connections between thousands of experiences and pieces of data. It'll be, I mean, maybe it's easier for it than it is for us, but it's hard for me to tell you why my favorite color is green.
Right. And I mean, if you were to ask AI, it's not going to give you an answer either. It's just going to try to like you said, explain all the reasons why green is good, but not necessarily why.
This is partially what Elon's been working on. I mean, a lot of people worked on this for a while, is like this sort of like data trail, or sort of like you want to print out of like, how'd you get this answer, GPT? Here's the algorithm or whatever. Right. And it doesn't work that way because it works like how a brain does. And there are some things that are out there that allow you to kind of get a better idea of where this stuff is getting pulled from. But we're in small models in comparison to what we're talking about in the future, because, you know, like I keep coming back to email as a good example, but like early days of email, it's like, could you probably list every email address in existence back then? Could you like create a database of them? You probably could, because the number of carriers and places you could get an email address were probably limited. They could all do an output. Today, do you feel like you could somehow get together every email address in existence? There's no way. There are just so many and like dead cert. I mean, God only knows. So it is one of those things that I imagine that there's things that are possible now that won't be possible in the future. But some degree of that is probably within capabilities that right. we have.
But moving forward and still on the same topic, OpenAI is in talks with dozens of publishers to license their content. This is from Yahoo Finance. OpenAI actively engaged in discussions with various publishers to secure licensing agreements for their articles, aimed at legally using this content to train AI models. The company has already signed deals with Axel Springer SE, the Associated Press. However, these efforts are overshadowed by the recent lawsuit from the New York Times against OpenAI and Microsoft, alleging that the unauthorized use of its articles for training data. This lawsuit presents a significant challenge to OpenAI's business model, potentially leading to financial repercussions and the necessity to exclude the Times content from its training data set. OpenAI maintains that its use of content is solely for training purposes and not for the reproduction or replacement, which differs from traditional copyright infringement cases. Nonetheless, the New York Times contends that OpenAI's actions constitutes unauthorized commercial use of its work. And that's kind of what we were talking about, the traditional copyright infringement cases.
Yeah.
And they're saying that it's different. So it's definitely going to be a legal battle between lawyers describing what copyright means.
Yeah, and I think you're going to have to use that example of the sort of like, what is the process of everyday sort of like public? I think there's that whole sort of like thing around privacy where it's like, when you're out in public, you know, like you have no, like your rights to privacy are different from when you're like alone in your home. And I think that you're going to find something really similar with this, where it's like, you know, in New York Times, like data that's proprietary that they use, like maybe to generate revenue directly, like people pay for it, or it's something proprietary in terms of the way that they gather information and then like turn it into content or whatever. I think that that'll probably be something that's copyrightable, or it's like the full work, you know, like a movie or something. But like, and today, like if you write a movie review and you write a quote from a movie, you're not going to get hit with copyright. But if you publish like the video of the entire film, it's like obviously, right? So I think that'll be something like that. The problem is like there's these gradients in between, and when you get into the middle, it's fuzzy. The thing that I find kind of like comical about this, though, however, is I can just imagine like both these stories, I've followed them both, but I'm not sure like the timeline for them, because I can just imagine OpenAI being like, hey, we want to license your content because we need that, because it's, you know, technically it's copyrighted and we're using it already. And they're like, wait, what? Right. Or they're like doing this deal and New York Times is like, great. And then they get in there and they're like, wait a minute, you guys have been doing this already? Like, I don't know. I find it kind of interesting. We'll see. There's a part of me that secretly hopes that it's such a headache for them that they stop trying. And I say that because I actually think that for publishers, one of the worst things that could happen, I think it's just bad for publishing and news in general, is that OpenAI and just AI models in a sort of like shortcut, sort of like way to sort of like quickly crank out faster, newer, better models, in terms of like not trying to build something that's robust enough to actually like get information properly from every place that you possibly could. Like the shortcut would then be like, hey, we're building these models really fast that just need info. Let's just get it from like 12 places. And like, yeah, it might not be as robust or as accurate or as good, and there's bias or whatever, but we're trying to go fast, and it's just easier to deal with 12 people than it is with like 60 million. And Google's like that sort of like everything that's a headache and a problem for OpenAI with that is everything that Google has been like, that's what we want. We want that because we don't want to have to work with them. We don't want them to have a voice. We don't want them to be able to negotiate, because we want to build the product our way, and like they're our supplier. They're supplying us with content. OpenAI is looking at it quite a bit differently because their suppliers in this case, they need to limit it. Their suppliers are a risk for this reason specifically, right. Is they don't want 60 million lawsuits. They want 12, you know?
Right, right.
So I'm kind of hopeful that maybe it's a headache, and maybe the legal process gives me zero confidence, but innovation does. And I think one of the things that we're going to find in all of this is that many of the things that we're arguing over are going to turn out to be stupid in 2 or 3 years, because there'll be other avenues and there'll be other systems that are just better. So in content API from, you know, 12 publishers to OpenAI will be, you know, like, sure, take that whenever there's like a global network of APIs for all content or something like that, that everybody can tap into. Cause then why would you deal with 12 whenever everyone else is free?
Right. It's going to be interesting. Cause I think it'll be like, kind of like how cable companies like YouTube TV will then partner up with new content providers and then integrate them into their service. It could be something like that, where they have a partnership with 12 publishers. Yeah. They provide all their data, and then all of a sudden they strike a deal with the New York Times, and it's like, big announcement, New York Times is now going to be integrated into
OpenAI. Yeah, and some of these ideas aren't necessarily unique, but I can imagine, I think that that's definitely the direction that a lot of things would go. But it really just depends on sort of like the railways, and you find the big tech, they're brilliant at cutting each other off the pass. Apple lives in this really brilliant space where they're on the device level, so they can literally cut everybody else off before they even get to the internet. And so with that, it's like, imagine you have models trained on your phone, and now you don't even need any of these tech companies making AI models because it's on your phone. So why would you go to them to then connect with this like network of content APIs whenever you can just connect with it yourself, like right. direct to consumer? Publishers would like that too. But now you've got Apple as a gatekeeper instead of Google. And I don't, as smart as they all are, I don't think any of them get to make these decisions. And the most sort of like crass and sort of savvy business move you can possibly make if you're in executive positions in any of these companies alone won't be something that I think is able to fully turn the tides one way or the other. But it'll be interesting to see. I think as a publisher, you have to focus on, again, the thing that your product, which is your content, make it good, connect with your audience. And if you ever get scared by this stuff, just remember, like, nobody's saying they don't want content anymore. Like, we need it more. Like, people want it more. They want it better. The reason why this entire conversation is taking place and why there's these huge $100 million lawsuits, $100 billion lawsuits in some ways that take place is because content is so valuable. So there's always been a market for it. And if you continue to do it and you focus on your audience, like, it comes to you. You'd be surprised.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like the tried and trusted route to take as a publisher.
Yeah.
And then just touching on this last story from theguardian.com, ChatGPT and OpenAI openly said that it was impossible to create AI tools like ChatGPT without copyright infringement material. They declared that using copyrighted material is indispensable for developing advanced AI tools. In a submission to the UK's House of Lords committee, great name, House of Lords. OpenAI stressed that the breadth of copyright covering human experience expressions makes it unfeasible to train AI models without such material. The company argued that restricting training data to public domain content would result in AI tools inadequate for modern needs. The statement comes amid a lawsuit from the New York Times and others. OpenAI typically relies on the fair use doctrine to justify using copyrighted material for AI training. The company maintains that copyright law doesn't prohibit AI model training and advocates for independent analysis and safety testing. And OpenAI has also committed to collaborating with governments on safety testing for their powerful models following a global safety summit agreement. Notably, music publishers, including Universal Music, have filed a similar lawsuit against Anthropic, an Amazon-backed company, for allegedly misusing copyrighted song lyrics in their AI model.
Yeah. I mean, you can go back to, the case where, Google got caught stealing copyrighted song lyrics. Everybody was like, see, we caught you, because, they put that, an extra character or something in the lyrics just to, prove. And then Google's like, oops, that's our bad. We actually weren't doing it right. That's not how we meant to. And then the judge in that case was like, well, they said they didn't mean to. So, and it's like, that's the one thing that I think is important. And this is where let The Guardian, let The New York Times, let these old legacy publishers that have done this before and failed, because they're not great at innovation, but they are pretty good at sticking around. Let them be the ones that spend their money and find out how disappointed they're going to be at the end of this, because I find it humorous where it's talking about OpenAI. It's the statement that you read was, the company maintains that copyright law doesn't prohibit AI model training. Well, that's the company's interpretation of the law. And I can promise you that the company's interpretation of the law is not going to be the one that's always in your best interest. And you may find that a court, a judge, a government, the world might not agree with your stance either. And their stance may be wrong or there may be flaws in it or whatever, but all these things can be true and you can still be the one that's basically like left being like, it's not fair. And that's where it's like, I think you have to be really careful about trying to get on board with efforts or movements of people or parties that are wanting you to do something that maybe is against your best interests to basically try to negotiate against a party. These are behemoths for a reason. And as much as I hate to say it, publishers as an individual, you have very little influence and a very small voice. Could you try to band together? Yeah, but I'm a big believer in putting my time and energy into things where less than one miracle needs to take place. And I think that means that I'm going to try to figure out, okay, well, let me not try to negotiate against them. You know, let me try to just like find out what that system is, where things are going, and be able to thrive in it. Because again, content, the reason why these arguments and these things are taking place is because content is so valuable. And if you make it and it's really good, again, you'll find that the market comes to you. They can't make you make it and take it.
Right. Right. I do find it really interesting that they say that they rely on the free use doctrine. Because, I mean, granted that I'm not a lawyer, but to my knowledge, free use also falls like for educational purposes, right? So yeah. Like if you're in school, a teacher's allowed to use copyrighted material in order to educate.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. So, I mean, the thing that I find, I mean, like all these things we're talking about today, it's with this inference of like a future AI. Because the truth is the AI models that we have today are not, it's not like teaching a child. Like mm-hmm. That comparison, like it just doesn't work with the current AI models because they don't have that sort of like underlying It's a large language model. It's using words. It's not really learning concepts, behaviors, math, you know. But once it does, that it'll be more like teaching a child than it is feeding him like a, you know, plagiarism machine. Because today, you definitely can make the argument that it's more plagiarism than it is learning. Some people might argue with that, but it's true. And I think... Yeah, I think all these court cases are going to be based on the concept that these things, I don't think a judge is going to try to understand like how a large language model works. I think very few legal cases like this will be decided by someone or by someone's where afterwards, if you were to say, hey, explain to me, all the different programming languages that you would need to run a machine learning model, explain to me how they work. I doubt you're going to get any answers that make you feel like this was an expert that made the decision.
Yeah, I don't feel confident with that either, especially after the TikTok trials that happened last year where they were like, does TikTok access the home Wi-Fi network?
Is my phone TikTok? My grandson uses it. Can he call me on TikTok?
Yeah, yeah. You know, if those people are asking those kind of questions, I could see like a lobbyist making an argument though. Like if they can constitute a business.
Well, that's the thing is all the expert and the good knowledge is usually in the pockets of not the people. Mm-hmm. And in this case too, the, you know, publishers, again, small voice, no coordination, like small money. So, yeah, the smart money is on the other side of these things usually. But like I said, you make something extremely valuable. We wouldn't be talking about these things if it wasn't for the fact that content is super valuable. And we hope that you find our content valuable and that you listen to this show before OpenAI is able to index it, recreate me and producer Manny's voices, and then serve it to you automatically directly through your phone. Producer Manny, anything else?
No. I'm just really enjoying this comfy chair this week.
Yeah, I'm glad.
I'm glad that we're back for a brand new year. We're about to hit a full year on this podcast.
Full year. And I want to thank everybody for making it like a great experience. I improve my knowledge through the show, all the research and stuff that producer Manny puts together, all the hard work. It really helps me sort of formulate my thoughts on the space. And I'd love to do more just engagement with our audience. If there's things that you would like to hear from us or see from us or things that you liked, maybe the last couple 2 weeks shows when we were going through tools, do you like that? Do you hate it? Let us know. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
We'll catch you next time on The Publisher Lab.